Thank you very much, Susie. And please do keep that Bible passage open in front of you. You might have noticed that we're back in chapter 12, and we are started by reading there some of the verses that we covered last time before moving into some new verses. But that's because there's so much depth in what John records for us in this passage. So if you're new to studying the Bible, you'll soon learn that there are depths to the Bible that we keep loving it and studying it for a lifetime. And I hope we're going to see that this morning, because the gospel is a beautifully deep truth. Sometimes we simplify it. I think I sort of did this with the children's slot a little while ago, but we might say that the gospel is simply Jesus died for me to save me from my sins. Which is true. That is kind of the heart of the gospel in lots of ways. But in this passage, we are going to see that there is a depth to the gospel that goes way beyond that. And I pray as we look at it this morning, it would be a great blessing to us. Because chapter 12 is a key passage in John's gospel. It's a pivotal chapter. So far, we've seen Jesus do seven signs. Seven signs that have caused great interest to all those who saw them and heard about them, and have begun to give people an idea of who he is. Signs that have pointed to his glory. But we've also repeatedly heard Jesus say, "My hour has not yet come." He says this over and over again, and it's kept us interested and eager to find out about that mysterious hour. And then last week we saw him ride into Jerusalem. The crowds were waiting expectantly, and they gave him a royal welcome, a welcome befitting a king riding to his victory. It's a big moment, and it's surely going to be a glorious moment. And everyone wants to be a part of it. Everyone wants to see it. There's a large crowd. Because glory is deeply attractive, isn't it? We're naturally drawn to scenes of glory. On Monday morning, I was drawn to the headline on the BBC Sports page. Hang on, I've done all that. Here we go. About the England cricket team. There we go, sorry. I was drawn to this headline about the England cricket team's win over the South Africans in a series of crickets. On Monday morning, the headline said, "England show the game is about glory." And the first line of the article read like this. There was a quote, "The great fallacy is that the game is first and last about winning. It's nothing of the kind. The game is about glory. And it's about doing things in style, with a flourish, about going out and beating the other lot, not waiting for them to die of boredom." So, whether it's a glorious sporting performance, a glorious sunrise, a glorious royal ceremony, our souls were made to encounter glory outside of us, bigger than us. The vast crowds that have come to gather to witness the glory of our national mourning of the Queen's death are witness to that as well, aren't they? We yearn for something more, a bigger glory. And in John 12, we see this crowd in our passage drawn here to witness the glory of King Jesus. And expectations are running high, verse 13. "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel," they shout. The whole world seems to be going after him, as the Pharisees themselves have observed. They say this because the crowd in the crowd are some Greeks. And the Greeks represent the rest of the world. And it seems that these Greeks are proselytes. They are Greek converts to Judaism. Now, I don't know if you remember in Acts when Paul arrives in Athens and he walks through the city, and he notes that how religious the Greeks are. As he walked around Athens, he saw loads of statues of many, many different gods, and he even sees one that says, "To an unknown God." So the Greeks are a religious people, And these Greeks here have got as far as saying, we know there's one God, and we think it's the Jewish God. But there's still clearly a longing in their hearts. And now they've heard these rumours that finally God's king is here, the King of Glory. And so they come with this request to Philip, one of Jesus' disciples, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." They want to see him, to behold the glory of this king in the flesh. They're excited, eager, full of anticipation. And maybe you find yourself with a similar longing in your heart this morning. You want to see more of God's glory, to come up close, to truly see him and to truly know him as he is. We have no shortage of religious spaces around us, do we? There is as much variety of places to worship as there are varieties of ice cream. There are many places you can go to try and find God. And it might be that you've explored many of those avenues, but you still found yourself searching. Maybe you found the same in churches. Sadly, too many of our churches make it hard to see Jesus. They cover him up with icons and traditions and garments and religiosity. Or some by trying to be too cool and culturally relevant, but they forget Jesus. So instead of the longing to see Jesus being enabled, it's frustrated all the more. And maybe at first glance, we might think that these verses just add to that confusion. Maybe it seems like Jesus doesn't appear to answer the request of these Greeks, but they might see Jesus. But if we keep looking at what he says today, we will not be disappointed. Because the longing of Jesus is that we would truly see him. That we would understand what his glory is all about. It's why he came. And so beginning at verse 23, Jesus helps us to truly behold him in all the great depths of what he is revealing. As he responds to the Greeks with these words, "The hour has come." We've been waiting throughout John's gospel. We've been teased, but now the hour has come. That hour when everyone will truly see Jesus. The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And now he gives them the trailer of what it looks like. We saw a bit of this last week. "Truly, truly, I say to you." Remember, that means listen up. "Unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." Jesus is unveiling himself as the Son of Man. That is, the promised Messiah, the man who would come with all God's power, as promised in Daniel 7. And he shows us what it's going to look like. Death. His glorious hour has come, and the climax of it will be his death. His glorious hour. You can just imagine the disciples' faces. Seriously, Jesus? Maybe you just need to take a moment. Gather your thoughts. Take a moment. You can't be serious. What kind of a glory comes from death? Death is the ultimate defeat, surely, isn't it? Who wants to worship a Messiah that dies? Who wants to worship a God whose glory is revealed through death? But Jesus is undeterred. He continues with the message that will turn his disciples' world upside down. Because he adds, death will be the entry point for all those who follow Jesus. Every follower of him will have to learn this, verse 25. "Whoever loves this life loses it. And whoever hates this life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me. And where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honour him." And then in verse 27, we see the fullness of Jesus' humanity. Jesus was fully human. And in verse 27, we see that the fear of his death and the pain and the suffering he was about to go through was real. Now is my soul troubled. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I have come to this hour. Jesus is real. And his death speaks, and this death he speaks of is real. He faces it troubled and heavy-hearted, knowing what's in store for him. Yet he asks this rhetorical question. Shall I pray that I wouldn't have to go through it? No. This is what I came for. I came for this hour, the hour of the cross. He doesn't pray, Father, save me. He prays, Father, glorify your name. Here's the shock. He's linking his death with the glory of God. What is Jesus' greatest goal as he heads towards the hour of his death on the cross? Well, we've already said we know it's because he loved me. He loves us so much. That's why he went to the cross. That is true. But there's so much more to it. There are deeper and more wonderful levels to the cross than even Christ's love for you and me. And that is what we see in this passage. That the greatest goal at the very heart of the cross lies God's glory. Because Jesus dies to reveal God's glory to the world. So when he went to the cross, it wasn't only because he loved you and me, but first and foremost, it was because he loved the glory of the Father. Does that sound shocking to you? Well, I wonder if you remember last week, Chris challenged us with the analogy of the solar system. So, like an early cosmologist who thought that everything revolved around the world, when actually our cosmos revolves around the sun, we think everything revolves around us, don't we? And not only that, we can have a me-centered view of the world, but we can have a me-centered view of God's purposes and plans. But Jesus' statement here puts the right focus at the center. And that is God and his glory. There's a great song by Kirk Franklin. It's a very funky song that we've been listening to as a family called Love Theory. And one of his lyrics is this: loving you will be the death of me. It's a common phrase that Franklin cleverly twists to show that when we love and follow Christ, we die to ourselves. We are no longer the center of our lives. And Jesus is our ultimate example of this. He came to the world on a mission to reveal the glory of his Father. And he knew that this was his mission, that it would climax in the hour when he would die. We've seen throughout John's Gospel that Jesus is the eternal Son of God, one with the Father and the Spirit, the Trinity. And this tri-unity, one God in three persons, has existed in perfectly glorious love for all eternity. And this perfect love has one divine will: to share God's glory with a world that turned its back on him, to save humanity. And as he achieves this, God's salvation plan at its heart will reveal the full beauty of God's glory. And so even in the midst of his inner human turmoil, he has come to reveal God's glory. And so Jesus says, Father, glorify your name. And God the Father responds. As God the Son stands there in his humanity, this thundering voice, this thundering sound, God the Father speaks from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. And as John records this divine conversation between God the Father and God the Son here, we begin to see the depths of the glory of the cross. Because in verse 30, Jesus calls us to dive deep into another perspective on the cross, a perspective that continues to show us why God is so glorious. As Jesus says, now is the judgment of this world. Because Jesus' death reveals God's perfect justice to the world. Judgment literally means crisis point. And it's about being separated, a crisis point of separation. I've heard John T. Alcock, who some of us will know, illustrate this when he says, it's like a weightlifting competition. So two big lads get up and they go head to head to see who can lift the heaviest weight. And they start at the same weight. So they're lifting the same weight. And as they continue, the crisis point, the moment of judgment, the moment they are separated, when one of them wins and the other one loses, is one can lift heavier than the other. That is the moment of judgment, where they are crowned the winner. And the Bible is clear throughout that God will separate us as he judges between the righteous and the unrighteous. There will be a day when they will be decisively separated. The righteous to eternal glory in God's presence. That is where glory is. And the unrighteous to eternal torment outside of his presence. And so the question is, who are the righteous and who are the unrighteous? Who is right with God and who isn't? And sometimes we often naturally think that it's about the law and the Ten Commandments. And so those who have kept the good, kept the law and done good are those who are righteous. And those who have done bad are those who are the unrighteous. Well, the Bible is very clear. The problem is that none of us have kept the law perfectly. None of us have responded to God as we should. We've seen that throughout John's gospel, that we are all blind, we are all foolish, we have all turned our backs on God. And so God's judgment of the world should be a fearsome, terrifying prospect, because we're all unrighteous. Therefore, we all rightly fall under God's judgment. And Jesus is saying that God is about to reveal that judgment now. But once again, it's not going to be as we expect. God is going to turn the whole thing upside down. Because now, this hour, when Jesus will go to his death, lifted up on the cross, God is going to reveal something wonderful. He reveals that the judgment that the world deserves is going to come, and it's all going to fall on Jesus. Because through the cross, God will lay his judgment, the judgment of the whole world, on his son. When Jesus is lifted up on the cross, he takes the punishment for the whole world's unrighteousness, our rejection of him, all the bad that we've ever done. He takes it all on himself. That is why Jesus, in his humanity, is tormented at this point. He knows what's coming. The weight of the world's sin is coming on him. But the wonder of what this means is that now the cross is the new dividing line of God's judgment. And so how the world responds to Jesus' death is the great moment of his glory. Because the moment of judgment, the new crisis point when humanity is separated, on that final day, when you stand before God in judgment, he won't ask you, did you keep the Ten Commandments? Have you been good? Like when you visit Father Christmas at the shopping centre. God already knows the answer to that one. It's a big fat no. All that matters is how you responded to Jesus. That hour is the dividing line. This is how we are separated. That is the crisis point, the point of judgment. It means that because Jesus went to the cross, the holy God of justice can offer perfect mercy to sinners while still remaining perfectly just in dealing with sin. He's dealt with it. It's all on Jesus. And we can have Jesus' righteousness. That is the glory revealed at the cross. It reveals a God who in his judgment is perfect in both justice and mercy. What an amazing plan. But amazingly, the glory of the cross runs yet deeper still. Because now Jesus says, still speaking of that hour, now will the ruler of this world be cast out. Because Jesus' death reveals God's victory over evil. The Bible is clear. There is a powerful enemy of God. He has many names throughout the Bible: Satan, the devil, the prince of this world. And since the beginning of time, he has been whispering in the ear of every human, seeking to draw us away, to deny God's glory, to put ourselves at the center. And he sought to claim the world as his own. But he is merely a squatter, a thief. It's like the criminal who is involved in identity theft. They steal your bank details and begin to use your account. They claim to be you. They spend your money in your name. They claim what is rightfully yours and use it for evil. The devil has claimed the world as his own. He's tried to steal what belongs to God. He's a squatter who looks for a while like the ruler. But Jesus says, now will the ruler of this world be cast out. Now the imposter, the squatter, the fake will be cast out. This is the moment. This is the hour when he is cast out. The crime is revealed and justice is done. It's the greatest story twist of all time. As Jesus hangs on the tree, it looks like the ruler of the world has won. It looks like Satan has won. He's convinced everyone to reject Jesus and to kill him. But in reality, at the cross, Jesus is revealing his victory. He's revealing himself as the King of Kings, the ruler of life. At the cross, Jesus casts Satan out. And he takes his rightful place. And what is the result of this victory? Well, Jesus dives even deeper still, verse 32. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. Because Jesus' death reveals God's salvation to the world. And Jesus doesn't simply make salvation just possible. He brings it to effect. And he does it personally through the cross. A few years ago, our youngest son, Toby, fell into a swimming pool. It was a very scary moment. We were distracted for a while and we heard a scream and he was in the pool. And both my cousin and I jumped into action. We didn't stand by the pool and simply dangle a rope into him and say, grab the rope. We jumped in. My cousin did a beautiful swallow dive and looked like a true lifesaver. I threw myself in very ungraciously and looked very silly. But dangling a rope in, it might have made it possible for Toby to be saved. But he was struggling. He was beginning to drown. He didn't have the capacity to grab onto anything. He needed someone to get into the water, to bring him up and draw him out. So too, the death of Jesus is not just an invitation. It isn't simply making salvation possible. It's way more powerful and effective than that. As Jesus dives into death, he grabs hold of us, and as he rises from the dead, he powerfully lifts us up with him. He actively draws us up and into new life. R.C. Sproul puts it like this: God doesn't simply throw a life preserver, that's one of those life rings, to a drowning person. He goes down to the bottom of the sea and pulls a corpse from the bottom of the sea, takes him up on the bank, breathes into him the breath of life, and makes him alive. Jesus actively saves all those who are his from the grip of Satan and into the hand of God. If you're trusting Jesus, he drew you. Before you chose him, he chose you. You did nothing. He did everything. Does this mean that every person who has ever lived will be automatically saved? No, we've seen, haven't we, what has gone previously, that there will be many who reject Jesus. And we're about to see that again in a few verses' time. But what it does mean is that he will save his people, all those who are his chosen. And what we see in this verse is that they will be a completely diverse people. People from every tribe and tongue and nation. Because remember, Jesus is still talking to the Greeks here. He's answering their question. And the Greeks represent the rest of the world here. Jesus, as he speaks these words about his death, is saying, yes, you can see me. You can see me in all my glory. I'm about to make sure that anyone who wants can see me in my glory. And the way I'll do that is on the cross. The cross, which reveals the horror and torment of separation from God that judgment leads to, but gloriously also reveals the grace of God as his son takes that judgment on himself. So that God may be seen as he is, perfectly just, perfectly merciful, and fully victorious. People sometimes say it makes God sound a little bit egotistical to make it all about his glory. But it isn't egotistical, because God simply is glorious. Whether we recognize it or not, that is the reality. God is the creator and sustainer of the world. And he is perfect, perfectly loving, perfectly good, perfectly wise. He's omniscient and omnipotent. He is glorious. If we fail to recognize it, it doesn't make it any less true. But to recognize it is to see the reality. When I seek my own glory, that is egotistical. But God is God. God is by his nature glorious. And his glory is what we were made to behold. It's where true joy and satisfaction and fulfillment are found. Which is why the fact that Jesus came to show us that glory is such a very good and loving gift of God to us. As John Owen says, on Christ's glory I would fix my thoughts and desires. And the more I see of the glory of Christ, the more the painted beauties of this world will wither in my eyes, and I will be more and more crucified to the world. Maybe you're sat here today and you haven't yet given your life to Jesus. But maybe you can see how compelling he is. Maybe he's drawing you to himself today. I want you and everyone here this morning to see that the only appropriate response to the sacrificial, loving grace of Jesus is to say, I'm in. You've got me. You've got my whole life. You can have my future. You can have my career. You can have my money. You can have my hobbies. You can have my relationships. You can have everything. I'm all yours for your glory. Because the final thing we see in this short but deep passage is that the cross reveals how urgent it is that we respond. Verse 34, the crowd are confused. They don't get it. And Jesus said, the light is among you for a little while longer. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in the darkness does not know where he's going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light. Jesus says you haven't got long. Don't put it off. Don't keep ignoring my call, making excuses. Walk in the light. This is an urgent warning and a beautiful invitation. And I want anyone who is here this morning or tuning in online who hasn't yet committed their life to following Jesus to see this. Jesus wants you to see this. A life centered on us, a self-centered world, is a very dark place. And it finishes in a terrible place. Because if you don't accept Jesus, his gift of taking the judgment you deserve at the cross, and give your life to him, then one day you will have to take God's judgment yourself for all eternity. Jesus is the king. And you're either on his side or on the rule of the world's side, with whom you will be cast out. But Jesus comes to bring light. A light that we must search out and respond to while we can. And as you come to Jesus and you see his glory revealed on the cross and you believe in him, you can become a child of the light. There's a phrase that's become very popular in recent years that says that our goal in life is to become the best version of you. Well, Jesus reveals to us here that the best version of you is a version that has died to yourself, to the lie that you are glorious, and now lives in Christ, proclaiming his glory. Or more simply, being in Jesus is the best version of you. Consider how Jesus taught us to pray. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. As we begin our prayers, that is how Jesus says we should start. So have you responded to his call? Where do you stand? And if you have responded, what are you all about? What do people know you for? When people think about you, what do they think about? Let it be Jesus. Have you given your all to him? Are you all sold out for him? We aren't just here to build a nice little cozy church, a cozy social group for our comfort. We want to glorify God. We want to join him in his work of making it possible for all people to come to himself. We want to be a place that shines the glory of Jesus into this town, into our neighborhoods, that we might be at the heart of seeing this town transformed by the glory of God. That isn't going to happen without us being radically sold out for Jesus, giving our all to him. How are you going to respond to the rich depths of God's glory revealed in the cross? Let's take a moment to consider this. A moment of quiet in prayer to our glorious Father. Let's pray.